The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Hold it right there! Kay, you're going on report, asshole. Bringing a goddamn hooker on a delivery run?
And so it begins.
No, this is how it all ends.
Just in case anything went wrong.
Which it obviously did.
Sadly, yes. Almost immediately after launching, the missiles went wildly off course and hit Paris and Beijing. One landed in the Pacific Ocean.
Where was that again? Were the birds hot?
Edward. May I call you Ed? Alas, I truly dislike bloodshed. And you can still leave here alive? We know the man you are climbing with is an escaped convict. We only want him, not you, Ed. Not you. Stop protecting your friend. Tell us where he is, and you go free.
You got the wrong guy. Don't have a climbing partner. Work alone. I'm not the guy you want.
See? All you have to do is ask correctly, and civilians will tell you anything you need to know.
No, wait. Wait, I lied. I have a climbing partner.
No, you don't.
This is now a thermonuclear device, boosted by a tritium injector. The fireball alone will be 10 blocks wide, and the blast will spread over 100 miles.
Praise be to Allah.
Red alert. There's a super stallion on a parade ground getting ready to leave. Cargo must be Calvano.
Can't see it. There's too much flame and smoke.
We're on the way. Stay loose and... Got him, Lines. Their base is at Black Rock Mesa in McHenry County, about 50 miles deep in the heart of the Badlands.
In a world rife with human suffering, a nuclear madman pursues his twisted dream of salvation. Stonyman 92, Capital Offensive.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Thomas Penny. With performances by Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Dolores King-Williams, Colleen Delaney, Stephen Carpenter, Michael John Casey, Andy Clements, Nanette Savard, David Coyne, Lily Beacon, Nathan Bennett, Mort Shelby, Dylan Lynch, Ken Jackson, Christopher Grayville, and Jonathan Watkins. Deathlands number 85, Dark Resurrection.
John Barrymore Diggs staggered forward under the sickening roll of the tugboat's deck
his stride limited by the steel trace that connected the manacles around his ankles. Rain and wind-driven sheets whipped across his shoulders and back, soaking him to the skin. Water ran in rivulets down his pant legs and squished inside his boots. His beloved fedora was saturated as well. Moisture steadily leaked through its crown onto the top of his head and poured over the sides of his face. He was a drowned rat in chains, and he wasn't alone. Jack Lauren and Christy Roth lurched a few feet ahead of him. The albino youth and the tall redhead were similarly drenched, similarly hobbled, weaving from side to side as the slow-moving ship wallowed through oncoming seas. His longtime companions were shadows of their former selves. Christy's prehensile hair hung down around her shoulders in drenched, lifeless ribbons. Her hip bones protruded alarmingly. Jack's dead white but youthful face had aged. It had become drawn and gaunt. His weather-cracked lips were flecked with dried blood. His ruby-colored eyes had sunk in their sockets, and they burned with a fevered intensity. Standing beside them was the blonde Padre Islander boy, Garwood Reed, the same brave, defiant Deathlands 14-year-old who tried to lead the companions to safety during the assault on the grounded freighter. The pirates had transformed the youngest of their surviving captives into a stick figure with eyes rimmed by dark circles. JB was in as bad a physical state as they were. He had lost a lot of weight, too, and his hands were blistered and split. His mind wasn't right, either. He was having more and more difficulty concentrating, his thoughts continually plunging into a pit of self-directed anger. Even though they had been betrayed in the final moment by that shit-weasel fire-talker Daniel DeCipio, he still blamed himself for the capture of his comrades, and for this gruesome outcome. Behind JB and in front of Jack and Christy were 27 other prisoners. Their captors had passed a rope through their ankle shackles so individuals couldn't break ranks and commit suicide by jumping overboard and thereby avoid being worked to death. JB and the others circled around the main deck in a drunken conga line, marching to the beat of the Mattachine coxswain, who sat on a canvas folding chair on the stern. The hood of the pirate's plastic poncho shadowed his face as he pounded on a steel drum with a pair of rag-wrapped hammers. It was leg-stretching time for one-third of the conscripted crew. Every couple of hours, the Mattachine pulled one person off each of the 30 benches, leaving the remainder to row. The rest of the galley slave contingent, 60 souls in all, continued to row in unison under cover of metal, pipe strut-supported awnings that bracketed the port and starboard rails from amidships to stern. Among the chained rowers were Ryan Carter, Dr. Mildred Wyeth, and Doc Tanner, who watched from behind their long oars as JB, Jack, and Christy rounded the rear of the superstructure and stumbled across the heaving deck. Despite the rain, JB was grateful for the opportunity to move around. Sitting for hours, pulling at the oars, knotted his back and thigh muscles. The constant ache in his cracked but healing ribs had diminished. The pain still peaked every time he took too deep a breath. They had been rowing the pirate's massive ocean-going tugboat for 3 weeks, give or take. 3 weeks since the fall of Padre Island and the Nuevo Texican defeat. After the first week, it had become impossible to separate one day from the next. Such was the monotony of crushing, mindless toil. Rounding the stern, JB faced into the wind and the wet. Sideways blown raindrops spattered the lenses of his spectacles, partially obscuring his vision. He brushed away the drops with rag-bandaged, manacled hands. Dead ahead was a towering gray cloud that drifted alone like a monumental ship of the air. Its crest loomed high above them, hundreds of feet up into the grim sky. From its bottom edge hung a darker gray, ever-shifting veil. Where veil met sea, the water was pitch black and boiling from concentrated torrential rain. Steadily, inexorably, they were pulling for the very heart of the squall. JB and the others were forced back to their seats and re-chained to their oar. At the sound of the klaxon, the poncho-clad Mattachine deck watch immediately opened a hatch in the stern and started passing out plastic bowls to the captives. Even though the galley slaves were fed morning and night, they were wasting away. It was inevitable. A matter of calories burned versus calories taken in. Their morning meal was a ladleful of gummy, weevily corn porridge mixed with molasses. The evening meal was the same gruel sprinkled with flaked salt-dried fish, bones, guts, and all. Their food was boiled to mush in a cauldron on the stern deck. Chained to their oars, JV and the others ate hog slop while their pirate captors feasted inside the ship's main cabin. Fragrant spice and meat smells drifted out from the galley. Chilies, cumin, garlic, beans, rice, slow-roasted pork, deep-fried, freshly caught fish. The aromas made JB's stomach rumble and his mouth water. Food had some kind of special significance for the stinking bastards. His captors really did stink. After 3 weeks without a bath, JB knew he didn't smell so great himself, but the rank, eye-watering pong of his overseers forced him to breathe through his mouth whenever they stood upwind. Pillaged feminine jewelry, delicate golden bracelets and necklaces glittered around their boot tops and peeked out from behind the masses of waist-length, moldy dreadlocks. Some of them wore the torn, blood-stained, semen-stained dresses of their victims over the outside of their clothes. Gut-hook machetes, the standard-issue cutting weapon, hung in canvas scabbards on their hips. The pirates carried stubby submachine guns of a design the armorer had never seen. During the one-sided battle for Padre Island, the Mattachine had worn mass-produced body armor, something unheard of in the hellscape. The trauma plate had stopped Christie's 38 rounds cold. JB had seen that with his own eyes. Inexplicably, the Mattachine hadn't bothered to loot Padre's beached container ship, which was full of what JB and his companions deemed irreplaceable pre-dark spoils. They just let it burn. A month earlier, beyond the southeastern edge of the Houston Nukeathon in Port Arthurville, they had joined forces with Harmonica Tom Wolfe, a seagoing trader of renowned skill and legendary savagery. He had opened their eyes to the possibility that the basic assumption that Deathlands was the sole nexus and the pinnacle of human survival and culture might be 180 degrees wrong. During the companions' multi-day voyage east from Port Arthurville to Padre Island, Harmonica Tom had passed on rumors about pockets of pre-dark civilization thriving in the southern latitudes nearly untouched by nuke strikes. Were the Mattachine pirates a scouting party from a much more advanced, a much more populous culture? Was it possible that a complex industrialized society had existed side by side with Deathlands ever since Nuke Day? If that were indeed the case, then JB knew he and his comrades faced an adversary with overwhelming advantages. But there was no guarantee that any of the success strategies hard won in the hellscape would save them. By the skin of his teeth, Harmonica Tom had escaped capture at Padre Island on his 40-foot sloop, Tempest. The companions might have made it to safety too if JB's rib injury hadn't held them back. That he had been the crew's weak link, that his infirmity had brought them to such a fate, stuck deep in the armorer's craw. The tug lurched so violently to starboard that JB nearly fell headfirst over his bucket. Catching his balance, he looked up and saw Ryan and Mildred sitting side by side, hauling back on the same oar. Doc occupied the bench behind them, his lips moving as he muttered to himself nonstop. The Victorian time traveler looked even more scarecrow and skeletal than usual, his clothes hanging loosely from stooped and shrunken shoulders. Wispy strands of gray beard did nothing to hide hollow cheeks. All three bared their teeth as they leaned hard into unison strokes, struggling to make way against the gathering headwind and jumbled seas. The cloud looming before them cast a vast shadow, turning the water beneath it inky black. As the downpour grew stronger, the air temperature plummeted. The water came down like a waterfall, hammering the metal awnings, flash flooding the scuppers. As JB struggled to keep his seat, the deck lights above him snapped on. At least it wasn't chem rain. This was drinkable water. 5-gallon buckets on the deck filled in no time. The deck watch forced the slaves to pass them hand to hand down the file and dump them into the stern's freshwater holding tank. Again and again, the process was repeated. Buckets allowed to fill to the brim and handed down the line. When the tank was finally topped off, The Mattachine sealed the hatch shut, then ducked back under an awning to escape the Cascade's pummeling. JB squinted up at the wheelhouse, two stories above the main deck. He glimpsed the pirate captain leaning out through an open side window, chewing on a stub of fat black stogie as he peered down at them. His dreadlocks were piled high atop his head and laced with golden trinkets. Through the shifting veil of heavy rain, against the glare of the deck lights, JB could see the stinking bastard was laughing his head off. The convoy's lead tug rumbled onward through the dead, still night. Diesel engines shook the deck under Ryan's boot soles. Thick, caustic smoke poured from the twin stacks atop the superstructure, enveloping the stern. Deep breathing was difficult. The smoke burned his one good eye, and it left an awful, scorched petrochemical taste in his mouth. It was still better than rowing, though. He'd had enough rowing to last him the rest of his life. Oars chipped, the Mattachine were powering toward what he figured was their ultimate destination. The Atlantic had turned black glass smooth under a starry, moonless sky. In the distance, on the starboard side, its oily surface reflected a narrow band made up of brilliant points of light. White, yellow, red, green, dotting, demarcating an otherwise invisible shoreline. As the bow crested the widely spaced swells, the lights lurched skyward, then abruptly dropped. Landfall, the first in more than 3 weeks, drew inexorably closer. The lights definitely weren't from fires or torches or anything combustible. They glowed steadily, which meant electricity. Massive quantities of electricity. What bobbed ahead of them was no looted carcass of an underground redoubt, no shit-hammered hand-to-mouth vill, no nuked-out urban ruin. This was a city, as cities were rumored of old, and from more than a mile offshore, it looked to be very much alive. Ryan glanced at the exhausted human forms hunched on the benches around him. In the deck lights, the slaves' filthy cheeks were streaked by tears, their lips trembling, their eyes wide with fear and panic, and the prospect of an unknown fate. Faced with the self-same prospect, his companions had turned hard-eyed, resolute, deadly focused. Like Ryan, Mildred, Doc, Jack, Christy, and JB had spirits tempered in the furnace of continual conflict and bodily risk. Ryan nudged Mildred gently with his elbow, nodding toward the crescent of lights.
So, that's what the world looked like before Hell Day?
Pretty much.
From the bench on the far side of Mildred, JB leaned forward.
Where the nuke in hell are we? That's all still mechs, right?
I think it's Veracruz or maybe Tampico. They were the two closest big port cities.
One of the Mattachine deck watch leaned in under the sheet metal awning beside them. He was tricked out in full battle armor. There was malevolence in his smile.
You're looking at Veracruz City. Next to this world, Deathlands is nothing but sheet. And you Deathlanders will always be sheet.
With a satisfied sneer, the pirate turned back to his shipmates. As the ship angled closer to shore, the curve of a southward-pointing peninsula became distinct from the landmass immediately behind it. The tug beelined for a blinking green beacon that marked the deep channel at the tip of the breakwater. When the ship rounded the bend into the protection of the harbor, they hit the wall of trapped heat and suffocating humidity radiating off the land. The ship's horn blasted overhead. The five sister ships behind chimed in as well, announcing the Mattachine convoy's triumphant return. In the lee of the peninsula, under scattered bright lights on tall stanchions, were the remains of a commercial shipyard, docks and cargo cranes. The scale of the development dwarfed what they had seen at Port Arthurville. The structures hadn't escaped Armageddon unscathed, though. It looked like they had been slammed by tidal waves or earthquakes. Most of the metal-framed industrial buildings were flattened to their concrete pads. Towering cargo cranes canted at odd angles. Some had toppled into the water. The enormous docks were broken. Wide sections of decking were missing. Moored to the remnants were a hodgepodge of small trading vessels. Beyond the docks, where the peninsula met the mainland, stood a functioning power plant. Floodlights illuminated clouds of smoke or steam from a trio of tall stacks. The lead tug continued, hugging the inside of the peninsula, passing within 100 yards of another immense structure. A fortress made of heavily weathered light gray stone, also dramatically lit. Apparently constructed on an offshore island, it was connected to the mainland by a low stone bridge. Above its crenellated battlements, at either end of the enclosed compound, were cylindrical observation towers. Huge iron anchor rings hung in a row just above the waterline. In front of the high-arched entrance gate, small motor launches were tied up to mooring cleats. Eroded stone sentry boxes bracketed the gate. Even bathed in hard, bright light, evil seemed to emanate from the structure, from the very seams in its masonry. Ancient, squatting evil.
It's an old Spanish fort from colonial days, probably 600 or more years old. Those massive triangular blockhouses outside the corners of the bastion walls are called ravelins. They were designed to defend the main perimeter from attack by offering a protected position for flanking fire. In the 16th and 17th centuries, Spaniards used stone forts like that to store gold and silver mined from the New World. It could also defend the city from pirates and foreign invaders, French, English, American.
The question is, what is it now?
Those cannons sticking out of the battlements sure as hell aren't 600-year-old muzzleloaders. If I had to guess, I'd say they're at least 106 millimeter, with maybe a 1 mile range. That means nobody comes in or goes out of the harbor without coming under their sights.
As the tug motored through the sheltered waters of the harbor, past the fort's arched gate, a gaggle of armed men spilled through the opening, waving and smiling in welcome. They didn't look like the Matachine. No dreads, no battle armor. They weren't wearing uniforms as such, more like insignia. They all had crimson sashes over their right shoulders and opposite hips, and they wore off-white straw cowboy hats with rolled brims. Their shoulder-slung weapons were different from what the Manachin carried. The wire-stocked, stamped steel submachine guns were much more compact, like Uzi knockoffs, with the mags inside the pistol grips. Men in crimson sashes continued to pour out of the gate onto the dock.
Segman Garrison.
Fireworks flew from the battlements, arching high into the black sky, and there exploding into patterns of green, gold, and red. The tug chugged on, turning left for the nearby mainland. Off the bow, Veracruz glowed incandescent against the black velvet sky. The one-eyed warrior could make out individual pinpoints of light from the upper-story windows of the tallest buildings. At the edge of the city, a long pier jutted into the water. On it, a lighthouse stood guard. When the tug came within 400 yards of the pier, Ryan saw it was packed end to end. Thousands of people had assembled and were waiting for them to arrive. Another 100 yards closer, and he could see that the overloaded dock was just the tip of the crowd, which stretched unbroken back into the brightly lit city streets. There was no telling how far back it went. The throng was like a single entity, a vast amoeba thing in constant chaotic motion, only kept from spilling out in all directions by the building walls on either side. The tug pulled alongside the pier. A sea of sweaty brown faces greeted them. They held 10 times larger than life-size papier-mâché heads on long poles, which they jigged up and down. Some of the paper sculptures had flat noses, ornate headdresses, and leering mouths lined with cruel fangs. The colors were bizarre instead of lifelike. Glistening green or pink skins, pointed black tongues, insane red and purple eyes with yellow pupils. Ryan strained to read the words written across their neckplates. Atapul the First, Atapul the Second, and so on up to Atapul the Tenth. They were names, he figured. Ryan had no clue what the stylized images represented, whether they were gods or barons. But the meaning of some of the other sculpted faces was all too apparent. Bobbing in front of him on pikes were gigantic human heads with a ghastly bluish pallor, bleeding from nose, eyes, and mouths. Cheeks and foreheads were speckled with red dots. Their expressions were fixed in rictus agony and terror. Plague masks. Plague, like the one that had struck Padre Island.
Ryan, look!
Mildred raised her manacled hands to point toward the landward lighthouse end of the pier. There, about 30 yards away, on the end of a wooden pole, 10 times life-size, was Ryan's own face, or a close approximation thereof. It was crudely rendered and painted, but all the pertinent details were there. The black eye patch, the scar that split his brow, the dark curly hair, the single surviving eye, the bearded cheeks, the square chin. The only difference was the patch and scar had been reversed on the sculpture, as if he was staring into a mirror. There were more of the giant eye patch faces spaced here and there among the seething throng.
What the fuck is going on?
Harmonica Tom stood at the helm of Tempest, feathering the engine's throttle to maintain a constant safe distance from the row of ship lights in front of it. He ran the 40-foot vessel blacked out, as he had done every night for the last 3 weeks, every night since he'd escaped from Padre Island. Finding the pirate convoy after dark was a piece of cake for the seasoned skipper. The 6 target boats were always lit up, mast, bow, and stern. This to help keep them from crashing into one another. During the day, Tom had to lay back in his pursuit for fear a crow's nest lookout would glimpse his mast tops astern. The last thing he wanted was for part of the fleet to peel off and double back to check out who was following its wake. The seagoing trader was sure they'd have no trouble recognizing Tempest. He'd already used it to kick their asses once. Unfortunately, he'd only managed to sink a single ship while damaging 2 others. The fallback in pursuit meant he had to do some zigging and zagging to find the convoy again after sundown. No problem this night, though. The Mattachine ships were under engine power. Even the slave galley tugs were burning diesel. And they were heading in toward the coast, making for the corona of shimmering lights low on the horizon that marked Veracruz.
Well, well. What have we here?
It was starting to look like the Fire Talker's stories were all true. When he had first heard the tales of civilization survival in the South, Tom had wanted to get in on the ground floor, to be the first to establish peaceful commerce, to forge trade links with the more advanced culture, and thereby get his hands on some of its fabled material wealth. But after seeing what the dreadlocked emissaries of that culture had done to Padre Island, the entrepreneurship fantasies vanished. Payback had become his single-minded goal, and payback was his forte. Like other Deathlands traders, Harmonica Tom Wolfe had committed his share of morally questionable deeds over the years, but the horror he had seen at Padre had affected him deeply. The Nuevo Texican's passing hadn't been quick or clean, not like getting shot or stabbed or fragged by shrap. They had disintegrated from the inside out, cooked in their skins by fever, laying helpless in pools of their own bodily waste. These were folks he'd done business with for years, folks he respected. He even knew their kids by name, kids who died the same awful way. He'd had 3 weeks to stew over what had happened to them and why. From the evidence on the scene, it looked like disease had ravaged more than half the population before the pirates showed up. Tom had never seen or heard of anything like it. Of the islanders who were stricken by the plague, no one recovered. It was 100% debilitating and 100% fatal. And that wasn't the whole story. The outbreak had peaked just in time for the naval assault and invasion.
No way that shit's a coincidence. No way.
The Nuevo Texicans were anything but pushovers. Every man, woman, and child older than the age of 8 could handle a blaster, and they had plenty of ammo and heavy automatic weapons. Through cagey barter, they had accumulated some explosives, too. They had a good stock of Claymore anti-personnel mines. For 30 years, the islanders had successfully defended their grounded freighter and its stores against all comers. The question was, could a small force of Mattachine have overwhelmed the hardened, battle-tested defenses and superior numbers without help from the plague?
Those low-down, cowardly bastards.
The pirates lacked the manpower to take Padre Island hill by hill, and long-distance shelling alone couldn't do the job. The objective of the invasion by sea hadn't been simple familiar robbery, either. The Mattachine had blown apart the beached freighter and just left it to burn, as if it held nothing worth stealing. The objective apparently had been the destruction of all life and property. Tom took that as an insult to himself and to the Deathlands. And then there was the matter of Ryan Carter and his five companions.
No doubt about it, Tom. You dragged those good folks into a world of trouble and hurt.
They'd wanted to head east to offload the 125-pound cache of C4 they'd snatched, but he'd told them that they'd get a better price if they sailed west and dealt with the Padre Islanders. When the shit hit the fan on Padre, things had broken badly for Carter and the others. They were still alive when Tom had hightailed it for Tempest, but the last he'd seen of them, they were pinned down by pirates who were closing in fast. If they had managed to live through the assault, they would have been taken as slaves for the galley ships. In the 3 weeks since Tom had made his solo escape, they could have all died at their oars. More than once he had come across big-ass sharks lazily schooling around a headless floating torso with flesh hanging from it in a pale, bloodless fringe. Every time he saw the rad-blasted black fin circling on the surface, he'd divert course to see if it was anyone he knew. Harmonica Tom had a very straightforward rule for survival that had proved itself over the years. When the odds were good, hit. When the odds were shit, get. No way could he fight the convoy at sea and hope to win. In one sense, the farther south he sailed, the longer the odds got. In another sense, they actually improved. Off his ship, he would be unrecognizable, even to the pirates he had out-captained and out-fought along the treacherous Texican shoals. And if the pirate cities were jam-packed with people like the Fire Talker said, that gave him the advantage of invisibility.
A man who's careful and quiet gets lost easy in a crowd.
From the angle of the ship lights relative to the shore, Tom figured the convoy was going to make its first landfall at Vera Cruz. He backed the throttle to idle, but left the engine in gear, then lashed off the helm to maintain a steady course. Tom opened and swung back the cockpit door, then turned to the box-fed Soviet PKM pivot mounted on Tempest's stern rail. Unlocking the canvas-shrouded machine gun from its swivel, he carried it down the steep steps to the cabin. He removed the shroud, then fitted the weapon onto the sandbag tripod already set up at the foot of the stairs. After angling the barrel up to cover the entryway above and cockpit beyond, he locked the elevation. Tom scrambled up the stairs and attached the end of a steel tripwire to an eye screw on the inside of the open door. Descending again, he fed the wire through the other strategically placed eyes on the staircase, bulkhead wall, and the back edge of the galley table on the far side of the tripod. He tested the run of the wire back and forth for smoothness, then inserted the free end of it through the weapon's trigger guard. He depressed the trigger until the firing pin snapped on the empty chamber. Holding down the trigger, he looped the wire around it, pinning it as far back as it would go. Up the steps one more time, he pulled the cockpit door closed, which released the tension on the wire and allowed the trigger to snap back to ready position. Back beside the machine gun, he set the safety switch to fire and cocked the actuator, racking a live 7.62mm round. The next time the cockpit door was opened, the wire would draw tight. At the door's full outward arc, the pullback tension would break the trigger and hold it down. Tom buckled his holstered Model 625 revolver around his waist. From the galley table, he picked up his pride and joy, a 9mm, Heckler & Koch MP5 SD1 silenced machine pistol. He slipped the weapon's quick-release lanyard over his neck. Thus suspended, its plastic pistol grip hung even with his belly button. From a hook on the wall, he grabbed a duct-tape-patched olive drab poncho and pulled it on over his head. The poncho left his arms free and draped low enough front and rear to keep both blasters out of sight. Though his skin was deeply tanned and weathered, he didn't know if it was tanned enough to pass for native. To keep his face in shadow, he donned a sweat-stained, frayed, olive drab bill cap. There wasn't much he could do about hiding his sandy-colored handlebar mustache, except to cut the damn thing off, and he wasn't about to do that. Shouldering a preloaded pack, he headed toward the bow, climbing the short flight of steps that led to the foredeck. Back out in the night air, he padlocked the forward companionway door behind him. Then he took a hand-painted sign from the pack and wired it securely to the hasp. Crude red letters on a white background read, Peligro, Danger. The middle of the sign was decorated with a crude skull and crossbones, under which was another word, Plaga, Plague. He made for the stern and jumped down into the cockpit. After padlocking the entry door, he hung a copy of the danger sign on it. Even if the locals couldn't read, he hoped the symbol of death would make them think twice before trying to break in. If not, anyone opening the door was going to get a big and final surprise. The stash of C4 was stowed in a secret compartment under the cabin's deck. To find it, the surviving intruders would have to tear the ship apart, bulkhead by bulkhead. Tom figured to be back aboard long before that happened. Either that, or chilled. Off Tempest's starboard bow, the last ship in the pirate convoy was rounding the blinking green light marker and heading into the harbor. Tom untied the wheel and goosed the throttle, steering for the marker buoy. He throttled back again as he cleared the light, slowing to take in the harbor and glowing city on the far side.
Hey, fucking amazing.
As the convoy passed in front of the battlements of a stone fort, a flurry of fireworks exploded over the harbor. Tom took the engine out of gear and let Tempest coast forward. He looked beyond the bursting rockets, beyond the floodlit fort, beyond the tooting convoy, at a four-story industrial complex just north of the city. Nosebleed-high catwalks, huge bottle-shaped holding tanks, smokestacks, cinder block buildings, it was all lit up as bright as day. The seagoing trader's face lit up too.
Yes, Lord, I see the light. But they won't.
He realized it was a power-generating station, probably of pre-dark manufacture, and still going strong after more than a century in operation. Diesel burning by the looks of the smoke, it had to be the source of the massive quantities of electricity in evidence around it. From his reading of 20th century books, Tom knew electricity in abundance was what drove the engine of social progress and material comfort, two things sorely absent in the Deathlands. He also knew that 70 or so pounds of properly placed C4 could inflict massive damage on the power plant. Maybe the locals had the technology and skills to fix it, maybe not. If not, it was going to be lights out on Veracruz forever. Every nightfall, the murdering bastards would have cause to remember the name of Harmonica Tom. Inside the harbor, it was much muggier. He found himself sweating bullets under the poncho. Peering through binocs, he saw all the armed men gathered on the stone fort's dock, waving at the convoy. He also saw the cannon barrels sticking out from the battlements. No way was he going to try to motor Tempest past them. There were no patrol boats in sight, no one to challenge his entering the harbor. That much confidence in their command of the sea made Tom conclude that no one had dared to challenge the Medellin for a very long time. The other boats underway in the harbor were all moving the same direction he was, but they were more than 1,000 yards in front of him, swinging in one by one to join the happy parade following the pirate fleet. Tom motored closer to the peninsula shore, looking for a place to tie up as close to the harbor entrance as possible. If everything went right for him, and wrong for Veracruz, getting out was going to be a hell of a lot harder than getting in. He swung in alongside a ruined freighter dock that jutted into the bay. Pools of light thrown by mercury vapor lamps on stanchions revealed clusters of small boats moored to the inside of the pier. They were a mixture of pre-dark, motor, and sail pleasure craft converted to commercial use. There were shit-hammered fishing boats with peeling paint, plywood cabins. The boats that couldn't find mooring space were rafted gunwale to gunwale. Poking ahead cautiously, Tom could see there was no free dock space, so he had to raft up too. He tossed out his fenders and pulled in beside a shabby fishing boat, then made Tempest fast to its bow and stern cleats. There was no one aboard the fishing boat, no one on any of the boats that he could see. Tom shouldered his pack and jumped onto the fishing boat. There wasn't any C4 in the bag. If he got caught with the blasters, he figured it was no big deal. But if he got caught with high explosives, his captors would want to know what he intended to do with them, and if there was more. The four-pane wood-frame windows in the side of the homemade cabin looked like they had been salvaged from a house. There were sun-faded girly picks stuck to the insides, facing out, so the crew could see them and be inspired. On the far side of the fishing boat, a steel ladder was affixed to the pier. He climbed the last few rungs cautiously, poking his head up to take in the terrain. The dock area looked as deserted as the boats, except for the rats scampering at the edges of the shadows. In front of him was a wrecked cinderblock warehouse, three stories high. The metal roof had partially caved in. The near wall had collapsed. Someone had started scavenging the fallen blocks, which were stacked on wooden pallets. When Tom stepped onto the dock, it seemed to move under him. He paused, trying to get his land legs. Then someone moved from the darkness inside the warehouse. Tom saw a pinpoint of light, a tiny red-hot coal. He tugged the brim of his hat down to further hide his face.
Oye!
A short, stout man in a straw cowboy hat and red sash stepped into view, puffing on a thin black cigar. He held a sawed-off blue steel 12-gauge in the crook of his left arm. It was hammerless, with a full rear stock and a leather shoulder sling. In the hard light from the mercury lamp, Tom could see food stains on the front of the guy's white dress shirt. They were bright orange, like chili sauce.
¿Quién es usted?
Buenas noches.
Tom turned slightly to the side so the guard couldn't see him drop his right hand under the poncho. The guard looked both puzzled and irritated, as though he hadn't understood a word of what Tom had said. His scowl deepened as he took a step forward. Advancing on Tom with the double barrel at waist height, his close-set little black eyes narrowed to slits. The guard bared his teeth.
¡Manos al cielo!
Tom lifted his MP5. Tom grabbed a lifeless arm and turned the man over. Working quickly, he removed the shoulder sling from the dropped scattergun. He grabbed a couple of concrete blocks from the nearest pallet and looped the sling through them. He then used the strap to attach the blocks to the dead man's ankles. Seconds later, he rolled the still warm body off the pier. It splashed into the water between moored boats and immediately sank out of sight. Tom tossed the 12-gauge in, too. He sailed the guard's straw cowboy hat into the darkness inside the wrecked warehouse.
So much for the welcoming committee.
He took one last look back at Tempest, then headed away from the water at a fast clip, in search of a road that would lead west to the power plant. He needed to get a close-up look at the defenses, if any, and at the site's structural features so he could parcel out and position the stash of C4 for maximum destruction. When he reached the main road, he glanced in either direction. There was still no one in sight. If the parallel rows of tidal wave damaged warehouses in the port area were deserted, the festivities in Veracruz had shifted into high gear. Tom turned left, heading toward the power station and the city. He traveled about a quarter mile down the middle of the road when the hair on his neck rose. He half turned and saw a pair of dim yellow headlights bearing down on him fast. It was too late to break for cover. Bracing his feet to stand and fight, he reached under the poncho and took hold of the H&K. The full-size, beat-to-shit Ford pickup slammed to a halt beside him. There were three well-fed, smiling men in the cab's bench seat. They appeared to be unarmed, and they weren't in uniform. They looked like ordinary guys, but they were more than a little drunk. The driver leaned an arm out his window, gestured toward the city.
Fiesta!
Tom nodded enthusiastically.
Entonces vamos!
The driver slapped the outside of his door hard, then hooked a thumb toward the pickup bed for Tom to climb aboard. Before they moved on, the guy in the middle of the bench seat reached back through the cab's missing rear window and handed the new passenger a bottle one quarter full of a pale yellow liquid. The oily, powerful spirits burned like hellfire all the way down to his belly. Not to be outdone by this show of gracious hospitality, he immediately passed out the dead man's cigars.
Eh? Eh?
His new friends accepted the smokes with delight, and everybody lit up. The pickup roared off down the road like it was going to fly apart on the next pothole. Harmonica Tom sat with his back against a wheel well. For the moment, at least, the belly of the beast didn't seem half bad. Christie eyed the giant, crude, one-eyed man sculptures.
It turns out you're famous here, too. They've got your head on a stick.
It's not me. It's ass backward.
The lead tug slipped in alongside the pier, with the two other tugs following close behind. When the crews hurried to tie off the mooring lines and extend the short gangways, the waiting crowd took that as a sign. Up close, the size and frenzy of the mob gave even Ryan pause. For the first time in 3 weeks of captivity, Ryan caught himself thinking that maybe they weren't going to make it out of this alive after all. It was a thought he couldn't come to grips with, and instinctively smothered.
Andale! Ha! Andale! Move, you scum!
Whipped hard across the shoulder from behind, JB lurched to his feet, his face twisted in outrage. He jerked at his chains like an animal, trying desperately, futilely, to break free, to get his hands on his grinning, dreadlocked tormentor. The Padre Islander kid, Garwood Reed, looked stunned, frozen like a rabbit.
Stay close to me, son. No matter what happens, stay close.
Flogged until they all got to their feet, the rowers were linked ankle to ankle and then driven toward the waiting gangplanks. As Ryan and the companions edged forward to the tug's gate, he saw men in red sashes and straw hats pounding back the crowd with cudgels and the metal-shod butts of sawed-off double-barrel shotguns. The sec men swinging clubs carried folding stock 9mm submachine guns on slings over their shoulders. With brute force, they opened a lane in the packed bodies to three stake trucks that were idling on the pier. The sec men held the path open with difficulty. As spectators surged forward, they had to be beaten back. When Ryan stepped into view on the gangplank, the mob on either side went crazy, pointing at him, jumping up and down. They started up a chant. Christie leaned forward.
Didn't I say you were famous?
What are they saying, Mildred? What's it mean?
Damned if I know. It's not Spanish.
At blaster point, Ryan, his battlemates, and young Reed were forced to climb into the back of the first stake truck. Like the other two vehicles, it was aimed toward the city center. When the bed was crammed full of slaves, 30 or so in all, a sec man slammed shut the wooden rear gate. The remaining trucks were likewise loaded and locked. Red-sashed sec men surrounded the vehicles, laboring to keep the crowd from surging forward and overrunning the prisoners. The companions had automatically moved back to back in a tight defensive ring. Garwood Reed did as he'd been told. He stuck to Ryan's side like glue. Even with the honking from the drivers and the trucks, nobody budged, and there were too many people on the pier for the vehicles to force the issue. Then the Mattachin started trooping off the tugs and onto the dock. They advanced in a tight military formation with their commander, the guy with the tallest piled dreads and the most pillaged jewelry, marching in the lead. When the assembled people of Veracruz saw the pirates in full battle gear and weapons bearing down on them, they made tracks backwards. Those closest to the Mattachin immediately dropped to their knees and pressed their noses and foreheads to the concrete. There wasn't room on the dock for all of the people to prostrate themselves. Those who couldn't bow down retreated as far from the pirates as they could, opening a narrow path for the trucks down the middle of the pier. The pecking order of the men with blasters was established immediately, Ryan noted. The red sashes standing next to the truck whipped off their hats, knelt, and lowered their heads before High Pile, the Mattachin commander. One of them, probably the most senior ranking, kneaded the brim of his cowboy hat as he spoke and then pointed up at Ryan. His words were lost in the din, but a smile spread over the captain's greasy face. High Pile jumped onto the lead truck's running board, reached through the open passenger window, and snatched the microphone.
The war is over. Eternal victory for the kings of death. The hero twins are captives.
Christie shot a puzzled glance at Mildred.
Hero twins?
It could be a mythological reference from ancient Mayan. More than a century ago, I did some reading to get ready for an archaeological tour of the major Mayan sites in Mexico and Guatemala. I sort of vaguely remember the term. Something to do with their creation story, I think.
The truck and its human cargo began to roll slowly forward. Out in front, the Mattachin phalanx parted the crowd with unspoken threat. Brian watched as a wave of prostration broke before them. Regular folk in red sashes alike supplicated themselves, pressing their faces into the ground. This wasn't a community of equals welcoming home their best and brightest after a successful military campaign. This was a subject people paying homage. The convoy proceeded at a walking pace off the pier, past the lighthouse and into the canyon of city streets. High Pile rode the running board like a king on a chariot. Ryan tried to read the sea of brown faces. Mixed in with overall jubilance, with the mind-numbing cheers, with the legions of fingers pointed excitedly up at him, he saw here and there flickers of shock, and even sorrow. The selection of jigged, giant heads on sticks was the same as on the pier. There were kings or demons, plague rictus masks and mirror images of his own bearded visage. The convoy crawled through a right turn, proceeded a few more blocks, and then made a left. On Ryan's right, 3- and 4-story colonial buildings loomed above the narrow street. The wall-to-wall facades were painted in bright pastels, aqua, pink, gold, and draped with spotlighted red banners. Stories-long, paint-on-cloth portraits of the array of ferocious kings, or devils. Atapools 1 through 10 varied in skin color and texture, as well as headdress design and height, width of nose, length of extended tongue, and position and shape of fangs. From every floor, people hung over the arched and pillared balconies. Some threw brilliantly colored confetti into the air, which fluttered down onto the heads and shoulders of the Mattachine phalanx. Lights burned in every window. At street level, the buildings opened up into cave-like arcades packed with markets and shops. The sidewalks were jammed with spectators and carts, spillover retail that included hot food, cold drinks, live poultry, cigars, and rack after rack of new clothing. As the trucks crept forward, Ryan picked up distinctive odors by turns. Camellias, spices, incense, fresh-baked bread, charcoal smoke, and grilled meats. It was ripe, fecund, teeming with energy. Wide-eyed, Mildred pointed with both manacled hands toward the ground floor of one of the buildings.
Oh, my God. Ryan, look!
What?
It's a Burger King!
Further explanation was interrupted by a barrage of garbage. As the trucks came directly under the balconies, the folks up there stopped throwing confetti and started throwing rotten fruit to the applause of the surrounding mob. The slaves ducked and covered as overripe mango and papaya splattered the bed of the trucks and their defenseless backs. The volley let up only after the convoy had crawled out of range. When their truck rounded a corner, Ryan could see it wasn't the tint of the spotlights that made the cathedral look red. It was painted top to bottom, the color of dried blood. Or maybe it was blood. The mob packing the cathedral steps broke apart before the wedge of Mattachine. The 3-truck convoy stopped. High Pile hopped down from the running board and climbed up to the stone altar that blocked the cathedral's main entrance. Pungent clouds of incense poured from brass censers on either side of the arched doorway. An old man with a sagging, deeply seamed face waited for him behind the dished-out altar. His headdress was made of scrolled posts and cross members of gold-painted wood. His brocaded, crimson robe didn't hide skinny arms and legs and a round, protruding belly. He looked like a hairless brown spider playing dress-up. Ryan noticed that while everybody else retreated with their noses pressed to the ground, the spider remained upright, as if he and the commander were equal in rank. Pirate and high priest conferred head-to-head for a moment in the cathedral's entryway. Then, with a flourish, the priest unsheathed a long golden dagger that he held over his head and turned for all to see. High Pile turned to face his men.
Bring them!
5 Mattachine immediately swarmed over the sides of the lead stake truck, jumping down into the midst of the chained slaves. The pirates booted aside the prisoners, moving with purpose in the same direction, toward Ryan and the others.
Together now.
The companions' 3 weeks of fury, suffering, and frustration exploded in violence. JB jumped forward to meet and block the rush of the first of the oncoming pirates. the much bigger attacker tried to bowl him aside with a well-timed shoulder strike. The strike missed by an inch or two when the armorer spun away and the pirate kept coming, stumbling forward off balance. From behind, Ryan threw his manacled hands over the top of the nasty dreads, pulling the connecting chain down over the filthy face, down around the unprotected throat. The pirate reached to his hip for the handle of his machete. As the long, wide blade cleared its scabbard, Ryan gave the chain a vicious twist. Ryan uncrossed his wrists, letting his stinking captive fall. Jack snatched the machete from the dead hand. Two pirates rushed in from the other side with whips cocked back. Mildred and Doc raised cuffed hands to keep from being lashed across the face and braced to absorb the punishment and protect the emaciated teen behind them.
It's the boy! They don't want us! They want the boy!
Jack, coiled like a steel spring, chopped an arcing, angled blow with the gut-hook machete that landed behind the nearest pirate's right knee. When the man's full weight came down, the weakened bone gave way. Mildred and Doc were on him in an instant. Mildred grabbed hold of the end of the whip. Doc smashed him across the face with both hands locked. As the man staggered back half a step, Doc seized him around the front of the throat, driving him into the wall of the steak truck. Displaying a reservoir of strength in the bottomless depth of his anger, the Victorian time traveler lifted the 180-pound pirate up on his tiptoes as he strangled him, two-handed. The two other pirates closed on the companions with their machetes drawn. Ryan and JB met the downward slashes on the chains. Ryan ripped the machete away. Because of his rib injury, JB didn't have the strength to tear his trapped blade away, but it didn't matter. He kept it tied up long enough for Christy and Jack to join the fray. They shoulder rammed the pirates off their feet, slamming them into the truck bed. As the companions regrouped around the reed boy, the rest of the pirate phalanx scrambled onto the truck. Ryan and his comrades fought in a frenzy, but hobbled by the bodies of the other slaves they were chained to, overwhelmed by the sheer weight of numbers, it was a lost cause from the start. After a couple of minutes, they began to fall, one by one, under the rain of blows. Ryan was the last to drop, struck in the head and neck simultaneously. As more blows pounded him to the deck, he felt the boy torn from his grasp.
No!
No! Let me go!
They watched through the wall slats as the Mattachine carried young Garwood, fighting and thrashing, up the steps to the altar. They pinned him on his back in the middle of the ancient stone slab, his arms and legs spread wide. With one hand, the spider priest tore open the boy's ragged t-shirt. The other hand held the golden dagger. Doc's hand gripped the wooden slat as he watched.
Lord, have mercy!
The priest drove home the blade. With a practiced, circular stroke, the priest opened a yawning hole beneath the sternum, and Garwood's body suddenly relaxed. The boy was already dead when the priest plunged a hand into the cavity past the wrist, rooted around for a moment, and then jerked out a handful of dripping red flesh, the heart. The priest raised the gory hunk of muscle to his mouth. He sucked a mouthful of blood from one of its severed vessels, then spit it out. He sucked and spit four times in each of the ordinal directions. Crimson rivulets drooled off his chin. Christy stared in shock.
Why him? Why did the bastards take him?
Because he was the youngest of the captured slaves. The young ones are probably the most prized as sacrifices to the demons they worship.
Or are forced to worship.
Looking around, he saw the stigma of the foul religion at every turn. The color of the church, the sashes of the armed sect men, the robes of the murderer priest, the banners hanging down the fronts of the buildings. When you are outnumbered big time, organized terror was the only way to control the subject people.
Maybe this place isn't so different than Deathlands after all. The Barons get obedience with violence and fear. The only thing different here is the scale.
There will be hell to pay for this abomination. By the three Kennedys, there will surely be hell to pay.
A civilian suddenly darted through the line of red sashes and jumped into the back of the stake truck before anyone could stop him. His eyes looked bloodshot and squirrely, like he was strung out on jolt. He had a long, thin-bladed knife clasped between his teeth, the sharp edge pointing away from his lips. Whipping the knife from his jaws, he charged for Ryan. Ryan easily deflected the too slow lunge with his manacled wrists and delivered a cracking headbutt. Doc seized hold of the attacker's arms and legs and threw him out of the truck. The red sashes swarmed in and pulled the unconscious man away. As the truck's engines fired up, Casacampo hopped back on the running board and the convoy resumed its slow-speed parade. They drove past a railroad terminal, obviously long abandoned. From there, the convoy followed the road's curve onto the peninsula. Behind them, the mob followed, clogging the street curb to curb. It trailed them for what Ryan guessed was close to 2 miles. Then the trucks turned off the road and parked on a stone quay between a row of stone buildings and the edge of the bay. 40 feet away, across the water, was the old Spanish fort. Bright lights aiming down from notches in the battlements illuminated a low pedestrian bridge that connected the fort to the quay. The captives were shoved out of the stake trucks and forced to line up beside them. As Casacampo pointed imperiously, the Matachine disconnected Ryan from the file and pulled him from the ranks and pushed him to the bridge. The far end of the bridge terminated at the point of one of the ravelins. The diamond-shaped projection, 3 stories of windowless, weathered limestone block, stuck out from the fort's perimeter. Ryan could see a narrow archway at the bridge's end and an open wrought iron gate. Urged forward at blaster point onto the bridge, Ryan glanced over the side. In the lights from the battlements, he saw bones. Human bones in the crystal clear water. The bottom was carpeted with mounds of them. Stripped white, jumbled skulls, long bones, ribs. There were darker blotches too, and they were moving sideways. Crabs the size of dinner plates crawled over the piles of naked bones, looking for a snippet that the others had missed.
Fat, happy crabs. Great.